than attempting to cross the wall. The 16-year-old St. Patrick was abducted from his home in Britain by pirates from Ireland sometime in the 5th century, although we do not know whether this occurred before or after the end of Roman rule. As we have seen, the details of precisely when and how Britain ceased permanently to be part of the empire are now lost. One source claims that representatives from British communities appealed unsuccessfully for aid from one of the Western emperors in the middle of the 5th century. There was also continued contact through the Catholic Church for some time. The impression is that the former British provinces split into a number of separate states led by kings or warlords. These may often have been hostile to their neighbours, fighting on a smaller scale the same sort of power struggles and civil wars that had ripped the Roman Empire apart. What happened on Hadrian's Wall in these last decades is even less clear. At South Shields, two skeletons with traces of wounds were discovered and dated to the early 5th century. It appears that they lay exposed for some time before they were buried in a pit in the courtyard of the old Praetorium. This violent episode, whatever its nature and scale, did not bring a final end to life at the fort, and some buildings remained in use. There is also evidence for continued occupation in several forts along Hadrian's Wall for at least a few generations. Someone had enough power on a local scale to maintain these forts in a reasonable state of repair, and presumably kept armed followers to act as garrisons. Opinion is divided over whether these were the descendants of the old garrisons and leaders, or chieftains from the new kingdoms that began to emerge. Whatever their origins, they are more likely to have acted like the war bands of tribal noblemen than units of a formal army. At Bodoswald, the collapsed granary building was used as the foundation for a large timber building, with old flagstones and other stones used as flooring. Another big timber building was subsequently built on the same site, and the nearby gateway was repaired. Both look more like a chieftain's feasting hall than a Roman military building, and generally the 5th century occupation tends to resemble a hill fort rather than the base of professional soldiers. However, the transition may have been gradual. The wall itself and its mile castles were occupied and in good repair for most of the 4th century, but there is no hint that this continued in an organized way afterwards. Power and society had become much more local. Perhaps some communities still liked to think of themselves as Roman and civilized, and did their best to maintain old practices, so that there was no abrupt change in lifestyle. Yet change there was over time, and as wealth and stability faded, so did the technical capacity and skill they supported. The remaining towns of the old provinces shrank in size, and the villas and other communities declined. No one was able to build new bathhouses or aqueducts any more, and before long no one was capable of maintaining the ones already in existence. An organized professional fighting force like the Roman army requires the support of immense political power and huge resources to sustain itself. These no longer existed in Britain, nor did they over time throughout the western provinces. Pockets of organized military and administrative activity may have remained for a while. The biography of Saint Severinus, who was active in the Danubian provinces in the 5th century, tells of an isolated garrison still doing its best to perform its duty, even though it had not received pay or orders for a considerable time. The unit sent a delegation to Italy in search of both these things, but the men encountered a band of barbarians and were massacred. Over the course of the 5th century, the influence and power of groups of Angles, Saxons, and other Germanic tribes in Britain increased. It should come as no surprise to listeners that the evidence for this is poor, often confused, and its interpretation furiously debated by scholars. What is not in dispute is that over time, Roman law was replaced by Germanic law, the Latin language by Anglo-Saxon, Christianity by a Germanic form of paganism, and the kingdoms that emerged in the post-Roman period replaced by new ones ruled by Anglo-Saxon dynasties that centuries later would combine to form England. The Roman Empire had gone, and little of its legacy was left in Britain, except in such western lands as Wales and Cornwall, where British kingdoms endured. It survived only in place names like Chester and Castor, both from the Latin castra, camp, and more dramatically in the remains of the roads and monumental buildings left from the Roman era. Hadrian's Wall was the greatest of these, but as time passed, it and all the others crumbled. Once Catholic missionaries converted the Anglo-Saxons to Christianity, the drive of kings and aristocrats to raise up ever more grand churches and monasteries encouraged the population to see the wall and other old Roman buildings as little more than ready sources of building stone. Much of Hadrian's Wall was deliberately taken apart, and its stone put to new uses as life went on in the lands and people farmed, tended their herds and flocks, worshipped in new ways, squabbled, and fought new wars. Lying close to, and in part on, what would become the border between England and Scotland, the lands around Hadrian's Wall have seen a good deal of warfare and violence since the end of the Roman era. Especially in the 16th century, these were the haunts of the Border Reavers, who raided and feuded for generations, exploiting the weakness of central authority. In 1745, Bonnie Prince Charlie came south with his Jacobite army of Highlanders and Lowlanders, Irish and Scottish regular troops supplied by the French, and soon some English volunteers. Their route was down the west coast, and General Wade, commanding the government forces at Newcastle, was unable to march fast enough to Carlisle to block their path, because there was not a road good enough for his artillery and transport. This failure prompted the construction of a new road in 1752, so that the same thing could not happen again. Unsurprisingly, the best route lay for many miles along the line of Hadrian's Wall, the remnants of which were demolished in the process, down to the foundations, which were used to build the road. Today, as you drive along the B6318, you are driving along Wade's Road on the line of the wall, often with the ditch on one side and the Walum on the other. History never stands still, and priorities change, as do memories. It was not that long after the end of the Roman era that the idea of what the wall had been became confused. That is, when people bothered to think about it at all. Writing near the middle of the 6th century, the British monk Gildas gave a muddled version of its history, claiming that it was raised after the end of the Roman province. In this version, the Britons first built a turf wall to repel the Picts and Scots, but when this proved ineffective, they sought aid from the Roman Empire. This led to an expedition and the construction of a more effective stone wall, which gave brief respite until its British garrison proved too weak to hold it. In the 8th century, Bede gave a marginally more accurate account, at least associating the first construction of a wall with Septimius Severus. But Bede was influenced by Gildas, or a common source, and has the 5th century Britons building first the Antonine Wall of Turf, and then a stone wall with aid and encouragement from the Romans. During the Middle Ages there was some confusion, but it was gradually accepted that there had been a great wall built by Severus, even if this was often associated with the threat posed by Picts and Scots. In the Renaissance, scholars began to piece the story together from the meagre mentions in the literary sources and the knowledge that a great feature was still visible on the ground. In 1584, the German traveller Leupold von Wedel saw a ditch which the Emperor Severus had ordered to be made to separate Scotland from England, and the foundation of a wall which the Emperor Hadrianus erected to hinder the Scots from invading England, as they used to do before. Curiously, this reversed the belief of contemporary scholars that the turf wall, in fact the Walum, was Hadrian's work, and that Severus built the wall in stone. This probably reflects the confused opinions of von Wedel's guides. It was only in later centuries that antiquarians began to unravel the story of Hadrian's Wall, a task that is still not complete. 10. Visiting Hadrian's Wall. The central section of Hadrian's Wall is the most visited, and for a very good reason. The forts at Housesteads, Chesters, and Bodoswald give a good impression of such bases, and each has its own museum, as does the civilian town at Corbridge. Vindolanda, Chesterholm, deserves at least half a day, for its site and ongoing excavations during the summer months, and also for the wonderful museum. Priorities for excavation change year by year, but the excellent website run by the Vindolanda Trust will provide details of recent and current activity. www.vindolanda.com. Its sister site, the Roman Army Museum at Carveran, is also worth a visit if you have the time. There is good walking with spectacular views of the countryside throughout this area. The walk for all or part of the way between Steel Rig, where there is a car park, and Housesteads is a particular favourite of mine. Not only is the landscape spectacular, but it also gives a very good introduction to the wall, with the excavated Mile Castles 39 and 37 and the unexcavated 38, as well as the additional turret at Peel Gap. If you begin the walk at Steel Rig, then the hardest part comes a few minutes later when you have to scramble up the steps and rocks at Peel Gap, which can be slippery in wet weather. If you are capable of this, then the rest of the walk should present no difficulties if you go at your own pace. It's also worth stopping frequently to admire the views and to turn and look behind you and see the wall running across the rolling land to the west. Walltown Crags are another favourite stopping place for those wanting a quick look at the wall, and these are also well signposted and provided with a car park. Walkers eager not to retrace their steps may want to take advantage of the bus service connecting many of the main sites. http://hadrianswallcountry.co.uk/travel/bus. If time permits, Milecastle 48 at Poltros Burn is rewarding, as is the Mithraeum at Caroba. The narrow temple to the Eastern God has casts of the Wattle and Daub inner walls and copies of the three altars found there. The originals are now in the Great North Museum in Newcastle. The fort of Carabra shows visitors what an unexcavated fort looks like, providing a good contrast with sites that have seen more work. There is a car park at both sites, although watch carefully for the sign to Poltros Burn, as it is a sharp turn to the left, just before the railway bridge, when approaching from the east. Carabra is on the military way, built by General Wade, the B6318, as is Limestone Corner. A drive along the road will give good views of the Walum and Ditch and take you past many of the key sites, so this is a good option for those without the time or inclination to do a lot of walking. Even so, sturdy footwear is a good idea for stops at the various sites. The path down to the Mithraeum at Carobra is usually muddy throughout the year. In the east, a visitor relying on public transport could easily fill a day in and around Newcastle, visiting Wall's End and South Shields, each of which has reconstructed buildings and a museum, and the Great North Museum in the city centre, which houses a major gallery of material from Hadrian's Wall. In the west, the Tully House Museum in Carlisle is good, and on the Cumbrian coast, the Senn House Museum at Maryport is also rewarding. For walkers with more time and energy, there is the Hadrian's Wall Path, running from coast to coast for 84 miles, 126 kilometres. The beauty of much of the countryside makes this a great pleasure even for those with little interest in the archaeology and history of the region. Several good guidebooks are available, and there are also plenty of details online, for instance at http://hadrianswallcountry.co.uk/walking/hadrians-wall-path-national-trail. Be prepared for all weathers, even in the summer. This concludes Hadrian's Wall by Adrian Goldsworthy. Narrated by Derek Perkins. Copyright 2018 by Adrian Goldsworthy. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Basic Books, an imprint of Perseus Books, LLC, a subsidiary of Hachette Book Group, Inc., New York, New York, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.